little warm introduction. I prepared this beforehand, sorry. Shifting to a totally unrelated topic, I wanted to talk a little bit about a movie, the part of the Rabbi Rap movie review series that we're having here. Thank you for those of you who were able to make it to Blues Brothers last week. The winner of the, I think, 2007 Academy Award for Best Foreign Film was a movie called The Counterfeiters. The Counterfeiters is a movie which is based strongly on a historical fact. And the story goes a little bit like this. Those who are interested, I think we're going to be playing it on Tisha B'Av afternoon. No, for real. Now who's laughing? So, that's a good crowd. So, in around 1943, I believe it was, the Nazis came up with the following plan. The Nazis went around to the various concentration camps and rounded up 140 inmates, and they were focusing on members of the printing industry, members of the graphics design industry, and members of the banking industry. And they took all of these people and they brought them to a place called Sachsenhausen, which was a smaller concentration camp. And they had set up a separate area for them. In this separate area, again, they didn't see any of the other inmates, none of the other inmates saw them. And in this area, they were given their charge. And their charge was to forge, create the greatest forgery ever of the British £5 note. And they were given 8-hour work days, and they were allowed to grow their hair, and they had a ping pong table there, and they had Sundays off. They were given good food. And their job was to forge the £5 note. The plan was that the Nazis would print millions, perhaps billions of pounds, and then, anyone know what they would do with it then? They would bomb England with British pounds and collapse the economy. Once the British pound became forged and so wildly accepted, no one would ever accept it as payment, and the British war effort would be crippled since they would not be able to buy anything. That was the plan. These gentlemen were quite successful. In the movie, they show how when they finally figure it out, and they say it was very difficult. Britannia was a very difficult picture to get an exact replica of. Also, they went as far as to, it seems that, perhaps there are other people who know this better than me, it seems that the British generally didn't carry wallets, but rather they would pin their bills together. So therefore, they would make small pinholes in the corner to make it look as they were actual British pounds had been pinned together. And at one point, they decided to really test what they had done. So they took one of their agents with a briefcase full of these and sent him to Switzerland. The agent went to the bank teller and told him, I'm involved in a certain business, and I've received these as payment. And I want to know, are these real bills or not? So I want you to look over these bills and tell me whether they are real, and if you will accept them as deposit. They took the bills, they went over the bills for a long time, they brought the experts, and they came back that, yes, these are real bills, we will accept them for deposit. The agent pressed his luck. He said, I don't want to discuss my business, but it involves a lot of money. As much as I appreciate your opinion, I'd like you to send it to the Bank of England and have them confirm it as well. They send it to England. England sent back a letter confirming that these were true bills. So, don't want to ruin the whole movie for you, because we really are showing it on Tisha B'Av. But they go on afterwards to forge the $100 bill. And $100 bill was even more tricky based on the printing methods. In the end, of course, by the time they do this in 1945, the Luftwaffe no longer has enough planes to fly anymore, and nothing becomes of it. The movie focuses on the relationship between two of these men. One of the fellows, whose name actually is Adolf Berger, the only person in the movie who they use his actual name, he happens to still be alive and lecturing on it, a spry 90-year-old, who was a political prisoner. He was involved, him and his wife had published anti-Nazi propaganda. For that, the two of them were sent to Auschwitz. His wife was killed. He was barely alive when they brought him out for this. He was of the opinion that I don't care what they do to me, they can kill me, but I will not help the Nazi effort. In fact, I will do whatever I can to sabotage it. And eventually I will be found and they will kill me and I don't care. Because the importance of stopping the Nazis is far greater than my life. The second character, who in the movie is called Solomon Sarovich, his name is actually Smolyansky, was the only career criminal among the gentlemen. He was known as the King of Forgers prior to the war, and he was arrested for forgery, actually. And he was as talented as there was in it. And he actually was keeping everyone alive because there's no one else who could possibly figure out how to forge the British £5 or the $100 bill. None of the other people there had any idea what they were doing. This guy was a pro. He is the one who says, every day I live is another day. And yes, as they say, we know we are dead men on vacation. Everyone knew as soon as this project was over, they'd all be killed. In fact, if anyone ever got sick, rather than went to a doctor, they would shoot him because lest the doctor should find out what was going on. However, he said that every day is another day, and therefore I will push forward, I will work slowly, and milk this for all I can. You know, I will not move any quicker until the point that, you know, they've got a gun to my head. But my life is my life, and so be it. I wanted to discuss who's right. Interestingly, this is a Gemara in Bava Kamma related to a piece in Shmuel Bet. How do you like that? In Shmuel Bet, towards the end, there is a story, a fascinating story, which says as follows, that David HaMelech is fighting against the Plishtim. He does a lot of that in Shmuel Bet, a lot of Shmuel Alf as well. And he says, Mi yashkeni mayim ibor beis lechem. Oh, what I would give for a good drink from the well of beis lechem. Now, of course, they were under siege at this point. It says that three of his greatest warriors hear this. They put their life at risk, and they go to Bor Beis Lechem, and they come back with water. They give it to David HaMelech. David HaMelech is outraged that they would risk their life for this. Pours the water on the floor, says, I'm not going to drink it. This isn't water, this is your blood. A fascinating story. However, the Gemara totally turns it upside down. The Gemara says that's not what happened. What happened was as follows. The question how the Gemara comes up with this. It says what happened was as follows. That David HaMelech was fighting against the Plishtim, and it was on Jewish soil. And the Plishtim had taken to hiding in piles of grain that were Jewish owned. From a war point of view, what would have been sensible is to set the piles on fire. However, it says David HaMelech asked the question, am I allowed to do that? It's not my grain. The answer came back as saying that in general the answer is no. However, you are a king, you have the right of eminent domain, and you can do whatever you want. That is Rashi's understanding of the Gemara. According to Rashi's understanding of the Gemara, the question is, can I burn down these piles of grain to save my life? The answer is, David HaMelech, you can because you're the king. However, if you happen to not be the king, the answer would be no. Indicating that I do not have a right to save my life with your money. That sounds somewhat crazy. Now, let's step out of Torah and into Mada for a second. And let's, are you familiar with the Heinz dilemma? Correct! When in doubt. When in doubt. The Heinz dilemma goes a little bit like this. The Heinz dilemma, I don't think, ever happened, but it was made up as one of the ways of judging people's ethics. So the case goes like this. There's a fellow named Heinz. Heinz Ward. No, Heinz Ward, actually. And Heinz has his wife is deathly ill, and she needs some radium in order to be saved. The local pharmacy has it, and they're charging $2,000 a dose, even though it costs them $100 to make. But they own the patent to it. They've invested a lot of money in R&D. They will not accept less than $2,000. Heinz borrows, he begs, comes up with $1,000, goes to the pharmacist and says, listen, this is what I got. Let's make a deal. You know, I'll owe you the money. What do you say? Pharmacist says, I say I can get $2,000 from other patients. Adios, amigos. The question is, can Heinz, and perhaps should Heinz, break into the pharmacy and steal it? What do you say? So, it was so crazy a minute ago that you can't save someone's life with someone else's money. But now, you're not so quick, are you now?
One guy's about to kill you. You have to worry about the grain of someone's about to kill you. It's a very bizarre...
Okay, well, now let's compare my case here of the Nazis. Okay? The question is, do I help them? So what's going to happen if they help the Nazis?
More people will die.
More people will die, right? England will be bankrupt, right? So again, directly is most likely England's economy will collapse. Everyone in England will lose all their money, more or less. Whoever has money in the bank, it's over. Whoever has physical assets, they're okay still, probably. And that likely, again, not for sure, but if I'm a Nazi, I'm hoping that leads to Nazi dominance. Which case is that like?
It's like the
Domela case? It's like the Heinz case? What's happening is I'm taking the English people's money. What?
It's one versus many.
So again,
it's a war.
Well, are the Nazis and the people in the concentration camp at war?
Isaac
clearly at risk in all the cases. Again, I assume that we can make the Heinz dilemma be imminent. Like she gets it today. Once you're making up stories, it's not that hard to do. You have a certain amount of flexibility.
What about the idea of Esther? That if you can judge what's right, then Mordechai says to Esther, it doesn't matter if you do it, someone else is going to do it anyway.
Oh, so you're saying historically. So that's a pretty good way of, you know, washing our hands of any moral obligation. I wouldn't try to apply that all that much. So, Rashi comes up with a shocking conclusion that, in fact, the question here was, can we burn down these piles of grain to save our lives? And basically the answer was, you yes, but in general, no. Okay? Rashi is a minority opinion, you'll be happy to note. Right? Tosfos says, there is no way that you can tell me that's right. That is impossible. Rather, Rashi has misread the Gemara. David HaMelech wasn't asking, can I save my life by burning this down? David HaMelech was asking, I'm going to burn this down. Do I got to pay back for it? Right? I'm allowed to do it. It's pikuach nefesh. You know? I have my rights. The question is, okay, the war's over. The guy comes to me with a claim. I tell him it had to be done. Do I have to pay him now for it? The answer was, no, you have eminent domain. You don't have to pay for anything. However, if somebody else would do something to save someone's life, right? If I, you know, if someone's running after me in a car to shoot me, and I pull out a gun, and I shoot him, and I blow out the tires, and it ends up it's not his car. So even though absolutely I was allowed to do that, but still I got to pay back for the car. Sorry, guy, you know, I actually shot out your tires.
Israel conquered other peoples, took their spoils, and left people behind. You have to pay them back for the spoils you took.
No, we're not talking about the enemy.
Jewish.
What? No, we're saying that the enemy doesn't count, but there's nothing to do with religion here. It's good that we brought him along. What? Oh, we'll get to that. Right. So so to play it out, you're saying, it is impossible that the fellows in the concentration will ever be able to pay back England. Right? I think that's a pretty streak. Yeah. Okay, so applying it to our case, you have machlokas between Rashi and Tosfos. In terms of poskim, the Rush goes along with Tosfos, right? It seems that basically most people follow Tosfos. However, according to Rashi, they would have to give up their lives rather than helping him. That Berger is right.
Where is Rashi? I mean,
we'll get to that. Okay? We'll discuss that. We're going to discuss it right now. Let's just do a wrap-up first. So first, Rashi, according to Rashi, they got to give the life. According to Tosfos, you don't have to. Where does Rashi come from? The Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us there are only three cardinal sins that one person gives their life for. They are?
Avodah Zarah,
killing and adultery. This is not Avodah Zarah. This isn't killing. This isn't adultery. So where does he come up with that from?
Indirect killing.
What?
Indirect killing, because if Britain falls apart, then
they will lose power. Rashi's not talking about the counterfeiters. Rashi is talking about the Gemara.
Great, okay.
Right? So.
But also there.
If I burn down your grains, you're going to die?
You don't burn down.
Right, because if you do, Rashi says you can. Right.
Well, burn down all his crops, he has no money, and poor person's like a maze. I don't know if they really apply it. But.
Yeah, have you not? What if whatever you're doing is making
things poor? So the Gemara should have said that, you know, if this could lead to killing someone else, it doesn't say that. The assumption is these people had piles of grain. You know, people with piles of grain tend to have, you know, some at home also. So the question, where does it fall? So one approach actually is that, yeah, that, you know, whoever steals is ki'ilu no tal nafsha, we say. You know, stealing money on a certain level is a subcategory, shall we say, of killing, perhaps. Now, this isn't such a crazy idea because you have other cases. For example, in the case of Yehuda and Tamar, right? People are familiar with the story. So Tamar is convicted. Tamar reaches into her pocket, pulls out a staff and then a ring and says, whoever this is, that's who it was. Basically saying, Yehuda, you want to fess up? You can fess up. If not, I'm willing to die over it. Gemara comments in Brachos that it's better that someone should be thrown into a fiery furnace rather than embarrass somebody else. Right? Because she was ready to die rather than embarrass him. Now, embarrassing someone, not adultery, it's not idolatry, it's not killing somebody. So the concept is that there are subcategories, right? And you know, when you embarrass someone, their face turns white, the blood runs from their face, it's a minor type of killing, perhaps. So one of the opinions is that, yeah, that's where it falls into. That, you know, it's like you're killing the person. No, that's a machlokas rishonim, whether it's a halacha or not. In fact, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orvach has a tshuva. So let's say I'm going to Denver for Shabbos, and my wife is home. And I tell my wife, you know, I'm going to Denver, and I hear what Rabinowitz did. And I'm going to get up from the drasha, and I'm going to bang on the table, and I'm going to say, Rabinowitz is a cow thief, he's a horse thief, and that's it. You can't handle it, and I'm going to let him have it now. Okay? And we're going, and it's already Shabbos in New York. It's not Shabbos here yet. And my wife gets that all my information was false. Can she be Machal Shabbos to call me to stop me from embarrassing somebody?
You're not going to answer.
It's not Shabbos here.
Oh, for you.
Ah, we're in Denver. Speed of light. So according to Rav Shlomo Zalman Orvech, seriously things that she should be Machal Shabbos because it's better to die. And if we're going to be Mechal Shabbos for Bikuach Nefesh, how much more so you should be Mechal Shabbos for this? That's pretty serious. So it's about Chokas Rishonim, whether you take it literally. But there are real poskim out there who take it really literally.
Rabinus is not a card.
Okay.
So he is.
Rabinovich is. Right? So, you have here, you have these examples where we put things into broader categories, right? The very famous case, another one is adultery can be taken broader. So there was a famous case in 1973, all the lawyers out there called it Friedman versus State, where there was a situation in August where, much like in Denver, in the Catskill Mountains, a lot of the ski lifts remain open in the summer, so you can go to the top and walk around. There was a young religious couple who were not married. They were going out on a date, and they went up on their ski lift, and they came down, and the ski lift stopped in the middle, and they closed up the park. And the two of them were stuck alone on the ski lift. The couple decided that this is an Isser Yichud. They were alone, no one was near, and that was a problem. So the young lady decided that Yichud is a subcategory of adultery. And with that, she jumped off the ski lift, doing great damage to herself. She then sued the New York State Parks Department for leaving her up there. The state countered by saying, yes, we were wrong for leaving you up there. If you have stayed overnight, you probably would have caught a cold. Here's $2 for some Comtrex or something, you know, and there's like damages. The fact that you're a nut and you decided to jump doesn't necessarily fall on our heads. And she claimed that, no, this is a religious obligation because Yichud is a subcategory of Giloy Arayas, of adultery, and therefore I was, and they marched rabbis in from both sides into the courtroom to decide one way or the other. And it's a published opinion, and the appeal is published as well. So this concept of taking a broader view. What do you think? You think she got money? Show of hands. How many people think that she won the case? Hands up. How many people think she lost the case? She won. America! So actually, no, it's unfortunate that she was married to someone else by the time of the decision came out, and she was divorced by the time the appeal came out. If you're really interested, I have her phone number. So we have this idea of stretching the Gimel Averus Chamuros, the three cardinal sins, to be all-inclusive. That's one possibility. It happens to be, this is even a little bit of a different case. If you look in the Medrash says that there are three cardinal sins that we give our life for. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, there is a fourth, and that fourth is Gezel. Rabbi Yehuda says that there are four cardinal sins, and this is the fourth cardinal sin. And once you say that, we're dealing with a whole something a little different. The Gemara does not quote the opinion of Yehuda, but it has a very interesting opinion of Rav Meir. The question is as follows. If I have an IOU, and it says that you owe me a certain amount of money, and there's two signatures on it, two kosher Edom, so you deny it. We go to court, the two Edom show up, and they say, yes, this is our signature. However, there was a gun to our head. We signed it under duress. It never happened. Do we accept the contract or not? Sam thinks not. Why? And your test? Yeah. So the Gemara and your test says that, in fact, according to our mayor, we do accept it. Why? Because if someone says to you, sign a false document or be killed, you should be killed. Therefore, if they signed it, clearly that wasn't the case. And if they say, we did it, ain't under Mason Matzma Russia, a person cannot testify against himself that he signed falsely, even under duress, and therefore it is good. So the opinion of Rav Meir in Ksubas would seem to be following the opinion of Rav Yehuda in the Medrash, both of which say that a person has to give their lives rather than steal. This is a fine collection of minority opinions. Lahalacha, the fact that what they've told you over the years that there are only three cardinal sins is probably true. There are only three of them. That is the case. This is not a fourth one. And not only that, we most likely follow the opinion of Tosfos and the Rush, even though there might be some support for Rashi. And the understanding is that a person can take money to save their lives. The question is, does that cover our case yet? There is a fascinating machlokes much later on between the Binyan Tzion. The Binyan Tzion was also the author of the Aruch HaNer, and according to some unknown positions, my great-great-grandfather. I just made that up. No, not really. So I was walking to shul once in Kew Garden Hills with Schneer Lyman. Right, must have had him here at one point. Very entertaining fellow. So we were walking down the street together, and he turned to me and he said, tell me, is your family from Germany? I said, yeah, it is. It's a good trick. He said, is the name Menachem common in your family? I said, well, my father's father is a Menachem. And yeah, we've got a bunch of Menachems in the family. He said, do you have a tradition that you are a descendant of the Aruch HaNer? So I said, no. Got me on that. He said, okay, I'll stop by your office in Yeshiva. So on Monday or Tuesday, he walks in, and he has a Sefer HaYuchzel Mishpachas Etlinger V'Harvitz, which is probably only one exists, and it's in his living room, as like so many other Svarim. And in it, it goes through the lineage, and it seems that the Aruch HaNer had one daughter, and his one daughter married Menachem Rapp in 1827 in Germany. And I said to him, now that I'm married, you tell me this? But we have daughters now, so the Yelta Zeta. So the Aruch HaNer deals with a fascinating shaila, a shaila that unfortunately I'm sure people are familiar with, autopsies. The question is, are you allowed to do an autopsy in a case where you have strong reason to believe doing an autopsy on this body will save the lives of another? You have some new disease, you have a criminal on the loose. Somehow or another, that we have, this isn't just a random or curious autopsy, but an autopsy that really can lead to the saving of the life. The Aruch HaNer, in his Sefer Binyan Tzion, passes that you cannot, even if it will mean saving someone else's life. Why? So among his points he makes is the following. He says that there is this Gemara Bava Kamma that we are familiar with. There is a machlokas between Rashi and Tosfos. Tosfos disagrees with Rashi. Rashi says you can't take it. Tosfos is saying, no, you can't take it. Why? Because you can pay it back. The king doesn't... What? You can burn down this grain because afterwards you can make the person whole. And since you'll be able to make the person whole, therefore, don't worry about it. Right. You're allowed to take it, but however, at the end of the day, right? So again, if you're the king, you don't have to do that make him whole thing. You can just take it. But everybody else will make him whole. So ultimately, of course, you can save your life because there's no downside to the other fellow. However, in a situation where you can, where you will be taking something away and you will not be able to pay it back, then you cannot do it. Yes?
But I would say that's analogous to these plishtim hiding in piles of garbage. It's valueless. It's useless. The dead body has no purpose whatsoever anymore. You don't need to pay it whole again.
So you'd like to know the next step. The question, how is this applicable to the autopsy case you're saying? Okay, I'm glad you asked. So he says, therefore, when it comes to an autopsy, it's not a matter of money. It's something far more important, a person's honor. There's a certain amount of degradation of the body by doing an autopsy, and that can never be paid back. So if I will not allow you to take money, how much more so I will not allow you to somehow violate the cadaver, the corpse. And therefore, since it cannot be paid back, you cannot save your life on someone else's back. That is the opinion of the Binyan Siyam.
What if it's to help generations, or to help solve a crime?
So guess what he says? Even though, this isn't even theoretical. I've got two patients, they've got the same disease we've never seen before. One dies, I cannot do an autopsy on that one to save the other. That is the opinion of the Aruch HaNer. What? Organ donors are beyond the scope of this lecture. What? All right, this isn't the current events discussion. That is the opinion of... Now, that is interesting because that... His understanding, let's bring it back. If you tell me the only reason that Tosfos disagrees with Rashi is because you have the ability to pay it back, as we mentioned earlier, the inmates will never be able to pay back the damage that they will do to England. So therefore, according to this, not only according to Rashi can't they do it, but according to Tosfos they can't do it as well.
It's not just financial damage to England, they'll be responsible for the lives of the future.
That's less direct. Again, we said there's two levels here. They are basically directly responsible for collapsing the currency. That, the assumption is, will lead to German victory.
Are
perhaps.
They actually directly, instead of the burglar, they're making counterfeit money, but they're not the one that's putting them on the plane and dropping it.
This is at least Lifnei Iver, because they can't do it without them.
Especially
right, because it's Trey Iver Denara.
This is one.
What?
He said there was only one pointer who really knew what he was doing. The other guy who was going to abstract as much as he could because he wasn't going to help the Nazis, he maybe, that's the kind of thing that can be flipped, the Esther thing. If he doesn't do it, someone else is going to do it. So he has a responsibility to his own life to try and save himself.
Right.
Whether,
so,
whether someone else could do it.
But on the other hand, he could sabotage it.
Yeah,
they could do it without him, but he could stop it. Or he can go in the middle of the night and smash the whatever and set it back 6 months. Yes.
So I'm not throwing in something.
Please throw in something.
The machlokas between Bar Petua and Rabbi Akiva with the one jug of water. So there was, when the Gemara, the simple understanding of the Gemara was that Rabbi Akiva was maintained that it's important for this person to keep his jug of water. End of story. But based on this understanding of Tosfos, at least Tosfos on the Rush, it should be okay for the other guy to hop it away and drink it and store it.
Who said it isn't?
Oh, I don't know. The similar thing of the Gemara seems to be Rabbi Akiva saying that you keep it, and it almost sounds like your chayach is quite up to him.
Well, let me just give you another case. So let's go back to Pinchas. Okay, Pinchas goes, he's going to kill Zimri. Let's say Zimri turns around, sees he's about to be killed, and kills Pinchas. Could we convict? So the Gemara says clearly that he'd be okay. He'd have a right to kill Pinchas, even though Pinchas was 100% in the right. So to here, one could strongly argue that, yeah, I don't have to give you the canteen, but that doesn't mean you can't beat the heck out of me and take it. Now, the argument against that is because this is a matter of killing someone to save your life. Me holding on to it, I'm not killing someone, I'm just keeping the status quo. You're grabbing it from me, you're killing me. And while I have a right to save my life over your life, I don't have the right to kill you to save my life. That we all agree on.
Isn't the Aruch HaNer assuming that this understanding of Tosfos, that Tosfos is saying you can only do it if you can pay back. But is it possible to understand that?
Oh, so
Tosfos is saying that he...
Is this something I said?
Something I said. That.
Right, so that's what the Maharam Shik says. The Maharam Shik disagrees with the Aruch HaNer. The Maharam Shik says absolutely that you can do an autopsy to save someone else's life because your understanding of Tosfos is wrong. The Maharam Shik says that the proper way to read Tosfos is as follows. Tosfos is saying that there are two different steps here. One, can I take your money to save my life? The answer is yes. Step number two is, now that I've taken the money, do I have to pay it back? The answer is yes to that also. This is not one question. Right? As far as it goes, he says, can I take the money to save my life? Yes, it's pikuach nefesh. Do I have to pay back? Yes, because it's not pikuach nefesh not to pay back. But Tosfos isn't saying, the only reason I can do it is because. So the Maharam Shik says that it's two separate issues. One issue is, can you take it? And the second issue is, do you have to pay back? And these are two unrelated issues. So therefore, the Maharam Shik argues on the Aruch HaNer and says, and I believe this is how we paskin, that we do autopsies to save people's lives. Because yes, you'll never be able to pay back, but them's the breaks. And so too, taking it back to the movie, you would be able to save your life this way, even though knowing full way that there's no way you'll ever pay back. As people have mentioned earlier, this isn't everything. This is all a good analysis of the case if we are dealing with one person saving his life using one person's money.
Also, they may not be saving their life.
What?
They're buying time.
It happened to be in hindsight. It's interesting. Hindsight, everything worked out great. They saved their lives and none of the money got dropped. It's interesting, just factually, what happened to the money. A lot of the money ended up going to Palestine and the Haganah used it. Yes. That's a fascinating historical footnote. It just gives you an idea of how, I mean, the history of how Israel got off the ground is fascinating. A lot of, where did they get most of their guns from? Any of the modern Orthodox religious Zionists know that? What? The Mafia. The Mafia in New York were major providers of arms. The Mafia, the Jewish Mafia controlled the longshoremen. So even though there was an arms embargo, a lot of the arms being sent to the Arab countries either accidentally fell off the boat or accidentally got sent to Israel. And through that, I mean, they had no arms. In 1948, one could make a strong argument that the war was won because of the Mafia, which is why it actually comes out even more interesting that, skip to the early 1970s, Meyer Lansky is on the run, shows up at Israel's door looking for asylum. Golda Meir turns him down. One has to wonder if that was the right decision, because if it wasn't for Meyer Lansky, one doesn't know if Golda Meir would have had a job at that point. Okay, see, so much of his education is missing here.
When I asked you about conquering and paying back Plishtim, you said, no, but this pile of grain is Jewish owned.
Correct.
When we talk about the Nazi situation, it's not Jewish money, or we're talking
It's Dr. Lightstone's money. It's Dr. Lightstone's money.
I'm just saying, you're...
No, I'm saying that it is Jewish money.
How's it Jewish money?
Who's going to lose the money here? Not the Nazis aren't going to lose the money. Who's going to lose the money if they buy it?
Britain isn't Jewish.
Most. I think
Most
they. I think.
With,
are there British Jews?
By the minority.
What?
Since when we passed them by the minority of a population?
What's a minority? So again, none of these people. Nobody in England is the enemy.
Uh-huh.
Correct.
Okay. Now it's not that it's Jewish, not Jewish. It's
right. Does that? Right. I can definitely, I can, if a guy attacks me, I can beat the heck out of him, take all of his stuff, you know, leave him bloody in the street. That's fine. But I can't, you know, take all the stuff and leave bloody in the street, somebody on my side, in order to do that.
Okay, so what matter whose file grain?
Right, this isn't a matter of Jewish, not Jewish. We love all people. Right. Okay. So, playing back here, so we said that ultimately, according to the Maharam Shik, what we said first is correct. You can save your life with someone else's money, even though you might never be able to pay it back. The question here, though, is twofold. One is you're not just stealing one person's money, and two, this isn't the matter of one individual. So both of these aspects have to be considered as well. There's a fascinating Gemara in Nedarim which says as follows, that if you have a two cities on a mountain, okay, one higher than the other, and there's a stream that runs down, and there's a limited amount of water. So let's say there's enough water for the people on top to drink and survive, but if they drink and survive, the people at the bottom won't, because they will finish the water. So the Gemara says the people on the top can drink, and the people on the bottom, that's the difference that breaks. What if there's enough on the top that the people on the top can drink, and the people on the bottom will also be able to drink? Well, the people out can drink and feed their animals, and then the people on the bottom will die. So the Gemara says, as you would expect, the people on the top drink, and the people on the bottom drink. Okay, what if there's enough that the people on the top can drink and feed their animals, and the people on the bottom will still be able to drink? Or the people on the top could drink, feed their animals, and do their laundry, and then the people on the bottom will die. So obviously the answer is, you know, the way it goes, first the people on top drink, then the bottom drink. Animals, animals, laundry, laundry. Rav Yossi says the people on the top do the laundry and the people on the bottom die. So, we don't necessarily follow Rav Yossi, but the question is, what was he thinking? What was he thinking? You know, someone asked, Graham asked me this morning, he said, I don't understand about laundry. If you ask me during the 9 days, we should all have to do laundry. I don't get any joy out of doing laundry. What a shocking turn of events. So, right? So I told him, you know, if you asked me, we should have to shave every day. Same idea, right? That's not how it works. So what was it about the laundry that they had to do it? So the answer is that you have to remember, one person not doing their laundry, that's yeshivish. Many people not doing their laundry, right? That is potential disease. When you're dealing on a larger basis, you know, that which is not as relevant on a smaller basis becomes very relevant, right? If nobody is washing in a town, that could lead to rampant disease. People will die over it. So therefore, if it comes to the matter that no one's going to do their laundry, no one's going to wash up, right? In order, so, yes, I don't have to save your life if my life is in danger. Similarly, to steal one person's money is bad. To bankrupt a country will be disastrous. There'll be starvation, there'll be famine perhaps, there'll be riots in the street undoubtedly. So one could argue that while perhaps I can take one person's money in order to save my life, to bankrupt a nation to save my life will inevitably lead to death, and therefore I cannot do it. Yes. Yes.
So if they dropped 5 pound notes, right, the British Parliament wouldn't realize that we just have to cancel the use of 5 pound notes and nothing would happen?
So, but I have 5 pound notes in my pocket.
So people would lose money who had 5 pound notes, but it wouldn't...
There's a lot of money in 5 pound notes. The equivalent of $6 billion in the currency.
I understand, but I'm saying if it was only 5 pound notes, I feel that...
So again, it was 5 pound notes and $100 bills. Both of them could do a pretty fine job of crypto. I mean, how high did the... Was the 5 pound note the highest note they had at the time?
Yeah, I think probably that was.
Right? During the war, that's probably was the largest bill, which means that all large wads of cash were kept in 5 pound notes.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I'm just saying that at that time, that was still when money was back.
I mean, the...
Gold or something.
So, no, they would have caught on, but what would they have done? Everybody who had the money, they would have to invalidate that as well. Right? All the old Jewish women with mattresses full of these would be up the creek. Well, if it, one would have to imagine if it wasn't, the Nazis wouldn't be wasting their time with it.
Judged by the way
right. I think they were aware of the fact. Again, of these 140, a large percentage were bankers. So, if anybody would know what's going on, it's the professional bankers that they brought in for this. So, So that's one way that we could differentiate. The fact that the scale of the robbery might raise it up a notch. The second point, which will also worth noting, is the issue of the bigger picture. Yes, I'm saving my life, but I am helping the war effort. The Minchas Chinuch has a fascinating question. He says, as we know that there are only three mitzvahs that you have to give your life up for. Maybe four. War is not one of them. There's a mitzvah to go to war, but the sad reality is you can get hurt doing that. So perhaps, halachically, people should be able to dodge the draft, saying that, listen, my life is in danger, I am not going to do it.
But isn't there one thing that going to war isn't said as a cardinal avera, mitzvah, but going to war is just a given that you need to give up your life for, because that's the definition of going to war.
You could have been the Minchas Chinuch. Because he said that's the definition of war. All these rules of Pikuach Nefesh doesn't apply to war, because war by definition means putting your life on the line for the greater good. And it is not a very large jump to say that these people were at war with you. So therefore, even I have a right to save my life. I also cannot help the Nazi war effort. I cannot strengthen the enemy. And therefore, even according to the technicalities, I should be able to do it. Still, it was improper to do it here, since this is considered a time of war. This is interesting. This came up as well in 1971, was it? Black September? 71? 70. 70? Okay. So in Black September, famous case, the Palestinians hijacked planes. On one of the planes is Rav Huttner. Rav Huttner was the Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin, one of the major yeshivas in Brooklyn. The Gemara tells us that we generally do not deal with terrorists. We do not buy back prisoners, because that will just encourage more of this. However, there are exceptions to the rule, and one of the exceptions is if someone is a great communal leader and the community really needs the person. The idea is that you're not overpaying, because their value is whatever you're paying. Many of the students of Rav Huttner put together money, and they were ready to negotiate to get his release. Probably his wife as well. I'm not sure.
She's on the plane.
Daughter. Oh, okay, maybe her also. Okay. The question was, are they allowed to do it? So there was a meeting about it, and as the saying goes, Yaakov Kamenetsky came up and says, no, you can't do it. Why? Because all the discussion about, you know, giving money to ransom somebody, that's only in a regular case. But during a war, to give money to the enemy to strengthen their hand? Absolutely not. So therefore, once we're dealing in a war situation, all the rules change. So again, even though technically we might be able to say from the individual case it would be allowed, both perhaps based on the scope of this, and second on the fact that they're at war, that could probably change the answer as well. It's interesting to note, again, this is all theoretical. No one's being judged here. No one's in the situation. But to note, obviously, many people worked in arms factories throughout the war. And the question is, you know, what should they have done? Obviously, we're not judging anybody. So what's most telling is almost nobody writes about this. Nobody even writes about it. And there are a lot of responses from the Holocaust. Bar Ilan has an entire section of it, a special, you have to pay extra for it, but the library's got it, so it's okay, and where you can look into this. They have one little-known piece on it, and that piece actually says that the people were allowed to do it. The idea being, in that situation, when it comes to making bombs, if you're not going to do it, there's plenty of other people that can do it. The question is, how applicable is it to this case, at least in the case of Smolyansky?
Didn't you say that was a weak moral out? Isn't
what?
That what Terry said about Esther, and he said that
well, I said over-expanding it.
Let me,
What? Glibly. I did say glibly, correct. It's on the tape. Somewhere you talk about it in a half hour from now. So the whole world will know.
What about Kastner? I'm saying that we traded things to the Eichmann to get the whole train of people.
Right. So the...
And the Satmarabi was on there as well.
Right. So the question is, I mean, it becomes a very on-the-point question. You know, how much damage will be done by what we're giving and how much are we getting back? It's not dissimilar for these, as to, let's say, the Land for Peace discussions. What are we giving? What are we getting? You know, obviously, do not try to pass on these shadows at home. But the one opinion I saw about this was the opinion that says that, in fact, being that this, that everybody's replaceable, it's going to get done anyhow, you're not really doing anything. You have the right and perhaps even the obligation to save your life. Well, at least one of them, it might be different. Again, this is all theoretical. No one asked me the question.
It's not just about money now, right? Because it's not just about Zayla. It's about any situation or, you know, someone who works in a concentration camp for the Nazis, for example. That would be the same type of...
Right. Again, if it was just Gezela, then probably we're okay. You know, there are opinions that say otherwise. You have Rashi, you have the Aruch Haner that say otherwise, but the majority opinion is that you're okay in that case. The question is, when we're talking here, when the scale gets ratcheted up so much and it becomes a matter of war, that might be a different story. Thank you very much. Yes.